KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Fisher Plumbing.
54 degrees in Seattle. Expecting a high today around 70, mostly sunny. Tonight's low around 48, mostly cloudy. Rain likely after 11 p.m.
KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Remember when many people were worried that an ancient Mayan calendar indicated the world would end in 2012? Well, archaeologist and Maya expert William Saturno has found proof that wasn't at all what the Maya thought. William Saturno joins us later in the show, plus Trent Temple Grandin on what new brain science has to tell us about people with autism. Washington lawmakers head into the second week of their 30-day special legislative session today. Jerry Kornfield covers state politics for the Everett Herald. He joins us once again. Good morning, Jerry. Good morning, Jerry.
I was only predicting special sessions. It wasn't the end of the world. It was special sessions it was predicting. Now maybe they need a Mayan calendar to figure out when the end of the session will come.
Well, right? You know, somebody was saying to us last week that these sessions aren't so special, are they?
Well, no, and I'm trying to figure out how we can start renaming them.
You know, extra sort of sessions.
That is
overtime.
First, regular, second, third, fourth. They don't become special until you get to about the sixth.
Well, so I know that the lawmakers have made progress on at least driving under the influence, right? That's sort of the one area that they've done something.
Well, they're getting close.
Should you want to start with that, or do you want to start with the big gorilla, the budget?
Oh, whatever you want. I mean, the one involving the impaired driving, that's a law that sort of popped on late in the regular session and has been, I think the governor said last week, 99% there. It passed out of a Senate committee on Wednesday. The House Public Safety Committee is likely to, work on and maybe pass a similar but probably not identical version. There are some changes each side wants to make. So it's kind of in the parking lot and getting close to parking, but I foresee that it may have another problem coming up, and that's the National Transportation Safety Board recently said, hey, we as a nation ought to lower the blood alcohol level, sort of lower the limit for how much alcohol you can have in your blood when you're driving from 0.08 to 0.05. And that could really affect Washington, especially if they have a tougher law. I mean, it can put a lot more people behind bars. So I have a feeling that may play into the discussions.
Well, let's leave the blood alcohol limit aside for a second and tell me where we are with what is the bill that's on the table right now?
Well, the bill that's on the table, it sort of aims at two areas. One is punishment, the other is prevention. And punishment, they want to do a whole bunch of things, like instead of making it a you can get four or five times for drunken driving and it'd still be a misdemeanor. And what they want to do is lower the number of misdemeanors you can get before it becomes a felony. So on your fourth conviction for misdemeanor, it actually would be a felony. And so that will get people into prison sooner. They also want to require that even on your second arrest that you spend some time behind bars, that you get an interlock ignition device so you can't start your car, and then they want to try to create for prevention a a program statewide, a sobriety program, in which folks would say, you know, you go into this program, and then we can maybe wipe off one of your arrests. But they want to get people right into a prevention program right away. So it's generally we'll lock them up sooner, and we'll try to give them a the key to getting out is going to be going through a sobriety program.
So when I know that the National Transportation Safety Board came up with these lowered blood alcohol limits last week sometime, but when might they actually even approve any kind of change? That's not going to happen this week.
Yeah, the state isn't going to take that up in the special session. And so they at the earliest that the state of Washington might even consider it would be 2014. And so that's why you have this sort of and the conversation really hasn't begun, but if you're going to make it, if you're going to start cracking down on folks and putting them in jail for longer times and sooner, you know, than based on how many times they're arrested, mm-hmm. if you now lower the blood alcohol level, you're going to catch, you know, a lot more people driving mm-hmm. drunk. And so a lot more people are going to end up in jail, and that drives up the cost. And so, you know, add it all together, it may not be a bill the state can afford. So we're going to have to decide, do we want to lower the level or do we want to lock people up? And they may have to wait till 2014 to figure out how they can do it together.
Interesting. Everett Herald reporter Jerry Kornfield's with us. Let's come on to the 600-pound gorilla. The only thing that the lawmakers have to do is pass a budget, and it's been pretty quiet as far as that goes, or at least up in Seattle it's been quiet. What are you hearing in Olympia?
Oh, it's pretty quiet here too, and I'm not quite sure if being quiet is a sign of, you know, concern. And so if it's quiet around here, does that mean they're still light years apart, as the governor said a few days ago, and we're going to be here a while? Or are they really getting some work done and just trying to keep it out of the public eye, and then when it comes public, they'll have an agreement? And I'm going to, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt that they're reluctance to negotiate in the press, as they say, which is a smart thing, means that they actually are negotiating behind closed doors, and in a few days they'll emerge with some kind of a pathway out of here. But there really hasn't been much. There was an interesting twist late last week. A Senate Majority Coalition, has dominated by Republicans, had put together a list of 33 bills that they wanted to be acted on, and as part of the final agreement. And some of them are policies that have not come up for a vote in the House, or policies that the governor doesn't support. So it's clear that they are put a lot on the table all of a sudden. Now, I don't think any of the bills are surprises, mm-hmm. but I think just having it out there lets people know that if they have 33 bills they want to talk about, it takes time to go through each one of those. And that's why people get nervous that they'll probably be here a while.
Now, these bills, are they directly budget-related, or are they just those kind where they deem them necessary to the budget and tack them on?
Well, it's a little of both. I mean, in the minds of the coalition, everyone is necessary because it involves, you know, it's policies they say will save money or make the, you know, some are like education reform, and it's some school bills that they want, as they say it'll make public school system better and make the dollars go farther. Some deal with the workers' compensation. There's one in there to allow the public employees and shift the pension system into so more of a 401k system rather than a guaranteed benefit that is there now. So those are all intended to either save money or transform how government and schools and other agencies operate. And so from the philosophy of that coalition, it's as important as figuring out, you know, how much to put in the reserves of the state budget.
It was interesting. I was reading the Seattle Times yesterday, which profiled Republican Andy Hill, who chairs the Senate Ways and Means Committee, which is the committee that is in charge of all of this. And I was interested to read that he has not a whole lot of legislative experience, although a lot of real-world financial experience. And I wonder about the relationship between those two skill areas. Don't you need a little bit of sort of inside politics savvy to get things through a legislative process?
Right, you do. I mean, the most, if you will, successful or skilled lawmaker, and it really doesn't matter if it's this legislature or Washington, has a nice little bit of moxie and a certain amount of gravitas to get to the finish line. He has the smarts, but he is in a difficult coalition, and it's a difficult group of people to together for the first time, and I'm not, you know, it's too early to say he doesn't have, if you will, the power to sway and build a majority. Right now he's just trying to figure out the budget, but he may have a little trouble delivering. He may come up with an agreement that works by all of the metrics in his mind and his experience in the real world, and then you go behind closed doors with your coalition, and it just doesn't pass muster. And he's going to, you know, I'm sure he's already encountered some frustration, and he'll encounter more. There's another little factor in here, too. They don't have 25 votes right now.
Right.
Because Senator Mike Carroll is ill, and he's not there. They may never have 25 votes in this special session. He may not be back to vote, and they may be working with 24, which will compel them to have to find votes in the Democratic caucus.
And as I read, at least three or four of the Democrats who initially voted for that budget say they only did it to sort of just keep the process going, and they don't like what's on paper coming out of the Senate.
Right. The only two Democrats who voted for that are likely to stay on the side of the Republican coalition are the two that are in the coalition, Senator Rodney Thom and Senator Tim Sheldon. All the others have made it very clear that they're a no vote without some level of new revenue. Now, it's not going to be as much as the Democrats in the House are pushing, but it has to be more than zero. And so I think until they see something that's more than zero, they're not going to support it.
Finally, the governor who last week sort of streamlined his goals for this legislative session made a transportation bill a priority, and it's kind of a meat and potatoes, for lack of a better term. It's not really a pie in the sky kind of transportation package that he's looking for.
No, well, it is and it isn't. It is in the sense that it's a big lift, if you will, politically, because it involves raising the gas tax and some fees. But then that money is targeted for projects that most people around here would think are pretty basic. You got to run, you know, you need to build a state ferry and run the system. You need to fill the potholes, maintain the roads. There are some highways that need expansion or improvements. And for those who live in Southwest Washington, there's talk of, you know, a new bridge over
right.
the river. All those seem probably basic to a lot of folks, but they have to pay for it, and that's always the most difficult part. So there's a rally today. Folks in Pierce County are coming down. Several hundred are expected to, you know, chant for a while on the steps of the Capitol saying, you know, we want some money for transportation. So we'll see if it's still tough to sell a gas tax increase right now, and the gas prices are going up. That's not going to help things.
In these special sessions, and you know, as we mentioned at the start, they're not really all that special anymore. They kind of happen regularly. Is there room for a lot of surprise?
It depends on what folks consider surprise. You know, everything that is going to happen is written down somewhere already or been discussed somewhere. I mean, I don't think you're going to see a surprise in the sense that you know, the Republicans are going to propose a tax increase that no one else has proposed or something really alarming like that. The surprise is often how quickly things can come together, that there's one or two linchpins, and once they get resolved, sometimes everything starts to just fall into place. It's kind of like making a puzzle, and you've found that one piece.
Hmm.
So that, I think, is a surprise with how quickly things can come together when they're ready to.
Well, Jerry, thanks for being our eyes on Olympia, and we'll be checking in with you again next week.
Okay.
Jerry Kornfield covers state politics for the Everett Herald, and he's been a regular guest throughout the legislative session and this special session here on Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
54 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today around 70, mostly sunny skies. Tonight, the low down around 48, mostly cloudy. Rain likely after 11 o'clock tonight. This is KUOW 94.9.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. After the Boston Marathon bombing last month, we heard a lot of stories about different kinds of injuries, amputations of limbs, severe burns, shrapnel wounds. We also heard about traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs. That's the shorthand used by doctors, patients, and caregivers. But what is the reality of a traumatic brain injury? Katie Sewell, you had that question.
I did. Traumatic brain injury. It sounds like such a blanket term.
Yep.
What does that diagnose actually mean for a patient's life? And what does it mean for the people who love and care for them? Julie Hall is the publisher and co-founder of Inside Bainbridge. She recently wrote an article titled "The Dead Zone: Living with Traumatic Brain Injury," about her life caring for her spouse, Sarah, who has a traumatic brain injury. I asked her how they first met.
We met at a publishing company in Chicago where we were both working, and we were in our 20s, and it was love at first sight.
So from that point on, since the love at first sight, it was you two together.
Yeah, we've been together since then, and it's been 20-some years.
She was in an accident. Did you know her before the accident?
No. She was in an accident before we met. She was in her early 20s. She was hit by a drunk driver. Her car was totaled. She was knocked unconscious and then received no medical treatment. People didn't even think about TBI in those days. It didn't really occur to her to go to the hospital. She thought she was okay. She was really young. And she just kind of carried on with her life. But I think that was the first blow. I'm sure that was the beginning. And then she had some neurological weird brain incidents where she couldn't talk, couldn't think clearly, and couldn't stand, couldn't walk. And they really didn't understand what it was, and they ended up releasing her on her way. And then she also was a soccer player. She tried out for like the pre-Olympics. So she took a lot of headers. And then probably about 12 or 13 years ago, she was just rear-ended by somebody. That precipitated the real jump in symptoms. Like, there had been symptoms, but they were subtle, and they hadn't really made us very concerned to the point where we sought medical help. But after that rear-end incident, she started in on an odyssey of seeking medical help.
So what kind of symptoms was she showing at that point?
She was starting to have memory problems, muscular problems, control issues, muscle spasticity, which is really typical of TBI, some more emotional ups and downs that weren't characteristic of her. She started seeking help from doctors. They gave her an unofficial diagnosis of MS. As it turns out, traumatic brain injury symptoms in many ways can be very like MS symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, we thought she had MS, but it just really never quite fit. After a while, we started wondering, you know, this just doesn't feel right. It doesn't quite look like MS. Her GP doctor said, you know, let's really aggressively look into this again. Eventually, she got a diagnosis a few years ago of traumatic brain injury, like after putting together a history of events, seeing the pattern and seeing, oh my gosh, okay, there was that car accident, and then there was that car accident, and then there was the soccer. And it was a real revelation. A lot of people said to us, oh my God, that you must be so relieved. And it was like, well, you know, yeah, we're relieved that she doesn't have progressive MS. That's a good thing. But she's still living with all the difficult symptoms that she's been living with. And traumatic brain injury is not it's not a happy alternative. Mm-hmm. So it was mixed.
When it comes to traumatic brain injury, is it progressive in the sense that it's becoming more and more difficult for her as time goes on, or does she have her symptoms and that's just what they are?
That's a good question, and it's not clear what the answer is. It does appear to be progressing. She definitely has been getting worse. Her case is very unusual because there was no discrete event. There wasn't a bomb that exploded. There wasn't a specific car accident where she was taken in and she was diagnosed with traumatic brain injury and then immediately treated. She's been living with this for so long that, as I understand it, it can get worse if it is untreated, which it has been for so long. She's highly intelligent. That was part of the ironic problem that I think kept her from being diagnosed for so long, was that she hid it so well and she compensated so well and she tested high. It didn't occur to anybody that she still wasn't testing at the normal level that she would be testing at if she didn't have a brain injury.
Julie Hall is the publisher and co-founder of Inside Bainbridge. And she recently wrote an article titled "The Dead Zone: Living with Traumatic Brain Injury." So when you think back to those early days when you met her, is she still that same person that you fell in love with?
Yes and no. She's still the vivacious, wonderful, intelligent, and kind person that I met and that I, you know, committed my life to way back then and had a baby with. She's also changed over the years, and especially, you know, in the last decade. She's had a lot of emergencies, mostly relating to muscle spasticity, which can be so severe with traumatic brain injury people.
Explain to me how her personality is different.
She's a very positive person. She's a person who's not easily discouraged. She's an optimist, and she's a really hard worker. All those things are still true, but it's harder for her to be positive now. She gets depressed. She has trouble controlling her moods. People with TBI have trouble reading other people's emotions and responding appropriately. Sarah's a very sensitive and aware person and empathetic, but it has made it harder for her to be those things consistently. And when she's tired, which is one of the biggest challenges of TBI, is fatigue. And it's a kind of fatigue that it's a brain tiredness that is so profound that it's not something that other people can really even understand. Your brain is working overtime every minute of every day to compensate for that dead zone, for that injury. And there are particular things that are especially tiring. One of the most tiring things is social situations. It really wipes her out. And so we have to pace ourselves socially, which can be really tough because other people don't understand. That's one of the hardest things actually about it, I think.
Do you find that that's true just with between the two of you, too? Is her interaction with you also tiring?
Yeah.
Even more
yes,
so.
Yes, it is. even more so. Yeah, I'm a high-octane person in terms of my interactivity. I like to talk and I like to share and process stuff with my partner. And it's really hard for her to keep up with that. And I don't expect her to anymore. I mean, it's unrealistic. So I've had to really adjust to that. And it's been very difficult. And I wouldn't say that I've gotten there yet fully. I don't know if I ever will, because I still have needs and I get lonely and I need somebody to talk to and I need a partner. And it's not the same to go talk to a friend. That's why we have, you know, a spouse or a partner. You know, that's a different relationship. It's more intimate. It's also hard for our daughter. She's 10 and she wants attention and a level of presence from Sarah at times that Sarah's just unable to give. And it's confusing and it's hard not to take it personally. It hurts. The other thing about TBI is that the person with the problem is often the last to know that they're having like a downtime or that they're having trouble. I'm usually the first person who sees it about Sarah, or I can even predict, okay, well, you've got this schedule this week or this schedule this day, and so you're going to be really wiped out. So you're not going to be able to do X, Y, Z. So you're going to have to take a nap. Another very major challenge for TBI people is executive function. for example, what am I going to do today? How am I going to achieve everything I need to achieve? In what order am I going to do the things that I need to get done? What are my priorities? And that is something that is extremely difficult for Sarah. She misses appointments. You know, yesterday she took our dog to the vet appointment, and it's actually scheduled for next week. And that kind of things happens all the time. And so I become the person who's the scheduler and the brain that tries to compensate for those deficiencies, which is hard.
Do you have a support system, or do you feel like you're rather isolated in this?
You know, I don't feel that I have an adequate support system. I don't feel like people understand well enough. And I guess that's one of the reasons I'm talking to you, which is kind of weird, but to have to go on the radio to talk about something so personal. But I think that's often the case in our culture nowadays. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we're looking for when we listen to people talk on the radio about their lives. We're listening for the truth and for what many of us refuse to tell each other, the truth of our lives, the inner lives.
Are you able to find joy in any moments, or is it sort of like your best friend isn't quite there anymore?
Oh, I definitely feel joy and gratitude for so many things. I mean, I love my life, and I love my daughter, and I love Sarah, and I love our animals and our raspberries and our friends. And but I definitely do often feel lonely, and like I miss her. I never know how much of her will be there present at any given time. You know, is it going to be really exhausted Sarah, who has just given her last bit of energy to conversation with someone or going out in the world and going grocery shopping or whatever, because she's so proud. She really hides it from people. She really pushes herself very hard. In human nature, it's what we all have to do. We rise to the occasion when we have to, and then we collapse at home with our loved ones. Mm-hmm. And in her case, it's just a little more extreme.
Julie Hall is the publisher and co-founder of Inside Bainbridge. She recently wrote an article titled "The Dead Zone: Living with Traumatic Brain Injury." Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW-Bothell Technology MBA program and the Leadership MBA program at Bellevue, featuring small classes and interactive learning environments. Now accepting applications for this fall. Details at uwb.edu/mba.
Archaeologist William Saturno has spent decades studying the ancient Mayans. He recently discovered proof that the Maya did not predict the world ending in 2012. He explains this morning at 10:15.
Support for KUOW comes from the structural engineering firm of Swenson Say Fage, with offices in Seattle and Tacoma, working collaboratively with architects, contractors, and homeowners, as well as public and private sector clients, to create effective building solutions. More information at SwensonSayFage.com.
53 in Seattle, currently heading up toward a high near 70 today, mostly sunny. Tonight, low around 48 degrees, mostly cloudy, rain likely after 11 tonight.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. According to most researchers, decoding the human brain is the most complicated and mysterious challenge we'll ever face. Our brains contain billions of neural pathways. They're conduits for everything from speech to the ability to compose music or to design systems, building systems, animal feeding systems, you have it. The new information about how our brains work also challenges many assumptions we've held about things like talent or about conditions that don't conform to the norm like autism. Temple Grandin's one of the world's most famous writers and speakers on the subject of autism. In her latest book, The Autism Brain, The Autistic Brain, Dr. Grandin examines what new research reveals about the brains of people who've been diagnosed with autism, including her own brain, and she challenges the common wisdom about what constitutes normal and abnormal, typical and atypical. Welcome back to Seattle.
It's good to be here.
I'm interested in your own brain scan. When did you first decide that you were going to undergo a scan?
Well, I've been doing brain scans as new technology has come out. In the late 80s, I did a scan here in California with Eric Corshane and found out my cerebellum was small and normal, which might explain why I have problems with balancing. But I want to emphasize, not everybody with autism has that symptom. Autism is a very big spectrum. One end of the spectrum, you've got somebody who remains nonverbal. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got half a Silicon Valley. Einstein had no language until age 3. It's a big spectrum. Now, the one thing that shows up on brain scans that's kind of universal, at least on the people that are verbal, is that some of the social circuits are not hooked up. Face recognition, recognizing subtle emotions on faces. I showed that abnormality on functional MRI. But some of the other scans are really cool. I'm a visual thinker, and I think totally in pictures. And a gigantic visual circuit was found. And if you want to see that, it's on the USA Today website. You can type in Temple Grandin, USA Today. And I basically have a giant association circuit. And my circuit for speak what I see is abnormal. And I had trouble getting my speech out. And then that circuit morphed into something else. I now know why I was so terrible in math. My left parietal area is full of water, and that sort of trashed out math. But again, I want to emphasize people on the spectrum are different because you have some kids on the spectrum that are super good at math. You see, the thing that seems to be uniform is the social awkwardness. And there's a point where this is just normal variation. But there's a tendency on kids that get labeled with autism, and I want to emphasize, diagnosis is not precise. I got a whole chapter in the autistic brain on diagnosis,
right,
and it's changed over the years. It's kind of shocking because it's a behavioral profile. But we got to work on building what the kid's area of strength up. My area of strength was art, and that was always encouraged. Another kid, it might be math, so build up math. He may have trouble with reading. My area of not strength was algebra. Other kids are good at words. Well, built that up.
We're talking with Temple Grandin, and you mentioned you started having these scans, almost 20 years ago. Now, the new scans are different. What you can learn, you had a recent sort of high def.
What's
fiber.
Called high definition tensor imaging by Walter Snyder. We need to give credit to the Defense Department for paying for this scanner.
Wow.
And the reason why they paid for the scanner is for head injuries. And I can tell you, the football players are not pretty. It looks like freeways after the earthquake. And what high-definition scanning can do is map the little white fibers. You know how Steve Jobs is going to have this office building that's a ring?
Right.
Well, the office is around the perimeter. That's the gray matter. But now imagine no courtyard in the middle, and you just have fiber optics connecting up all the different specialized departments. Well, in the brain, that's all the white matter circuits, and they form cable bundles. And these cable bundles can actually be mapped now for the first time. Older types of tensor imaging could not tell when fibers crossed or whether the fibers were an intersection. This new scanner can do this. So they were able to look at my speak what I see circuit, and that was undersized. Normally that circuit stops in the motor cortex, but no, it bushed out over other parts of the brain. And then my speak what you hear circuit was a teensy little thing. And a lot of these scans are in the book, The Autistic Brain, and the most spectacular one is on the USA Today website. Just type Temple Grandin, USA Today.
Do scientists know, they can scan the brain. Do they know what all those circuits actually control?
Yeah, actually they do. Now, the thing is, we've got the Hubble Space Telescope now for looking at brain differences, but you've got to learn how to use it. Well, the Defense Department funding doesn't pay for that.
No.
But the Defense Department is going to be putting these scanners around in the hospitals now for head injuries. We've got to learn how to use them. And what that's going to end up doing is breaking autism down into its component parts. Like, for example, you have two kinds of speech problems in kids. You got ones like me where you can't get it out, couldn't get it out. Another kind of speech problem is the echolalic kid. They yak out all these movie scripts and TV commercials, but they don't know what they mean.
Hmm.
You see, it's a different circuit there. But you'd have to, you know, in order to, you'd have to do what's called norming the test, where you're going to have to, like, 25 kids that have speech output, put them in the scanner against 25 kids that are controls, and then 25 kids that are the echolalic type of kids, and then see where the circuits are different. And that's called norming the test. You know, this would totally take diagnosis out of behavioral profiling and put it really into neurology. But I found out why I couldn't program a computer. I just don't have the circuits there. You know, I wanted to program a computer, but couldn't do it.
So it really is, when we talk about innate ability, we're really talking about innate ability. It's really something about how your brain is wired.
Well, especially on the extreme end. You get the people more in the middle. Yeah, that you get a lot of plasticity in the brain. But basically, the algebra circuit's just trashed. I've got a big asymmetry full of water. Hmm. If you look that one up on the Google Images website, where it's really pretty, you'll see two big, like, turquoise blue things in the middle of my head.
How many? I mean, you mentioned that a lot of these scanners are being put in for brain injury and concussion,
right.
traumatic brain injury. So it's not that common at this point for maybe kids, young babies, or even adults with autism to just go in and be scanned.
No, it's not. It's not. Basically, no, but the thing is, the therapy isn't going to change much whether you have these scans or not. And you don't have to be running out and jumping in these scanners to get good treatment. It's real simple. If you've got a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old that's not talking, you got to start working with that kid. Doing a lot of one-on-one teaching words. You got to teach these kids how to take turns, play games with them. You've got to engage them. And it doesn't matter what shows up on a scanner, that's going to be pretty much the same.
So I'm curious, this weekend the American Psychiatric Association released the DSM-5, which is the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and they've changed since the last one, which was, I think it was 20 years ago, how even what autism is or how you would look at it. So first of all, I want you to explain that, and then second of all, what does that mean?
Well, the Autistic Brain book has got an entire chapter on the history of the DMS. And when Richard Panik and I, like, laid that all out, it's pretty shocking how it's changed. These diagnoses are not precise. It's not like getting a diagnosis of tuberculosis. It's
right.
A behavioral profile. And they've changed the behavioral profile. You know, when it first started, they were mixing up autism with schizophrenia, saying it was psychological. You know, then every decade or so, they would change it. You know, and then in the 80s, you had to have speech delay to be autistic. Then in the early 90s, they added Asperger. In other words, you could be socially awkward with no speech delay. Now, they're taking that out, going to call that social communication disorder, because I think they're trying to cut down on the amount of services, and they've kind of muddied the waters on the speech delay. Now, one thing good they've put in there is the sensory problems. And we have an entire chapter in the Autistic Brain on sensory issues.
Right.
This would be one of my top areas for research, because how can you be social if you can't tolerate going to in a noisy restaurant?
Right.
But they're very variable. One kid's got sound sensitivity. Another kid's got maybe fluorescent light sensitivity.
So taking the Asperger's out of this recent DSM-5, is that good or bad for people who, you know, for 20 years have been told they have this syndrome?
Well, there's real concern about that. And my background is an animal scientist,
right.
And I'm trained in biology. And you look at things like on the brain scans, you can see things on that where there's an extreme deficit, like my math department, or an extreme ability. But you've still got to use things. My ability in art was developed. You know, some kids, they're good at art, and they draw the same anime character over and over again. I wasn't allowed to do that. They said, well, come on, not endless horse heads. Why don't you do the horse's stable? Let's do a beach. And when I did a picture of a beach, it was professional grade work. Some other put in the glass frame in the bedroom wall. I knew the difference between the bedroom wall glass frame and the refrigerator door. And you've got to develop abilities. I mean, like Malcolm Gladwell says, innate abilities don't matter. Well, in 1968, Bill Gates and I had access to the exact same IBM teletype. He could program it. I couldn't. And I wanted to program it, but I just couldn't do it.
So there's certain innate abilities, but whatever you have, there's doing it. There's the practice. So it's not just practice makes perfect,
Well, you need the practice,
right,
and you need the access. You know, you're not going to learn how to program the computer if you don't have access to it. That's for sure. But now there's free classes online for this sort of stuff.
But you also have to have that innate in your brain. There has to be that propensity for being able to do A instead of B.
Well, there's a lot of people where the brains are much more middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you kind of go the art route or the writing or the math route, you know, it's a lot more flexible. See, when you get different labels, that's when it gets really extreme. But I'm getting worried now with all this emphasis right now on STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math,
mm-hmm,
that us art thinkers are going to get screened out. But you know what you need us art thinkers? Because I'm the one that would have made sure that the nuclear power plant in Japan would not blow up. You know why that plant blew up? Because they put the emergency generators for the emergency pumps in a non-waterproof basement next to the sea. There's no way I would have done that.
Designers. The world needs designers, in other words.
You need both the industrial designer. Steve Jobs was an industrial designer. He wasn't an engineer.
You discovered something in the course of your life, which is that you see things in patterns, but different people see different kinds of patterns.
Well, there's two kinds of visual spatial thinking. And this is something I've observed for over 10 years. But in the Autistic Brain book, we've actually found research that supports this. There are two types of visualizers. I am the object photorealistic type, who thinks in very photorealistic pictures, bad in algebra. Then there's the pattern thinker. This is your mathematician. This is like, where are you located in space? Because in your brain, you got circuits of what is something. That's me. Then you got circuits in your brain for where is something. That's more the mathematician. And that's the kid where maybe when he's in third grade, he needs to take a sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade math book. Don't let him do baby math, but he's going to need special ed and reading. That tends to be the pattern when you get more on the extremes.
But it's interesting that both of those kinds of thinkers could be classified as autistic, which is...
Yeah, they can be. You see, the thing about... this is the problem with autism. It's such a broad, heterogeneous diagnosis, because then you got half the kids diagnosed with autism that remain nonverbal. They may have epilepsy and other medical problems on top of autism. You see, the one thing, at least in the verbal people with autism, that seems to be kind of universal is the social awkwardness and the social circuits not being hooked up. So you got to teach these kids social rules, like how to... Like you go into a foreign country and this is how you shake hands, this is how you do this. It's not picked up by instinct.
How hard was that to learn?
Well, in the 50s, it was pounded into all kids. I mean, I learned how to shake hands. I used to serve hors d'oeuvres at my mother's cocktail parties. And that taught important social skills. You know, you've just got to teach it. Another thing I'm so concerned about today is a lot of these kids get a label. I don't care whether it's ADHD, autism, dyslexia, smart kids, just kind of quirky and different. And they're not learning any work skills. When I was 13, my mother set it up with a lady that did freelance sewing for me to sew hem dresses two afternoons a week. When I was 15, I was cleaning horse stalls. And I've had people say, well, what motivated you? I wanted to prove to people that I could take care of the horse barn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was wanting to prove that I was competent. I put tongue and groove siding on our Skeeto house with white trim. You know, and I enjoyed the recognition that I got for some of these things. That's learning work skills. Also, there's a lot of grunt work, too, in learning work skills. And even in the best jobs, not everything's fun. And I'm seeing smart kids that are, you know, not keeping jobs because they don't get up in the morning and they're not willing to do some of the grunt work.
That's not just autistic kids. That's all kids.
But I'm seeing too many. You know, the thing with autistic kids, let's just say a label. I want to use this term more broadly. You see, you've got to get labels to get services in the schools. But I'm seeing too many kids with labels, and I'm talking about the milder end of the spectrums. And they go, oh, poor little Asperger's, Will orders hamburger at McDonald's for him. I go, no, he's going to have to go up to the counter and order his own hamburger. And yes, you've got to stretch these kids. When I was 15, I had a chance to go to my aunt's ranch, and I didn't want to go because I was afraid to go. Mother says, you can go for a week or you can go all summer, but I wasn't not going wasn't going to be an option.
Temple Grandin's our guest. Her new book is called The Autistic Brain. I think you were lucky in your genetics that you had the mother that you had. You could have had a different mother, but in this book you write that the initial diagnosis of autism was that it was the mother's fault.
Well, yeah, you see, when we go through the history of the autism diagnosis, originally it was blamed on refrigerator mothers and it was all psychological. That's absolute BS. That was back in the 50s and the 60s is when that stuff got really going.
But your mom, I mean, that's when you were coming up.
Well, fortunately in the 50s, she wasn't exposed to much of that stuff. And And the very first doctor I went to wasn't a psychiatrist. It was a neurologist. It was Bronson Crothers at Boston Children's Hospital. And he's a neurologist. And he checked me for epilepsy, which was negative. And he checked me for deafness. Now, I want to tell you something about the hearing tests. You can pass a hearing test, but that tells you nothing about auditory detail. That's the ability to hear the hard consonant sounds. Like my speech teacher would hold up a cup and she'd go, cup. And then she'd go, cup. And she'd stretch it out so I could hear those hard consonants.
One thing, I think the most fascinating part of this book for me, there were a lot of interesting things to touch on. There's a lot in a very short book, is the sort of the idea of reframing assumptions about ability and disability.
Well, you have to make sure you don't become the label. One of the things that's really bad with the autism label is at one end of it, you've got Einstein and half a Silicon Valley. Yeah, now one of them's come down with autoimmune problems, which also tends to go with autism. I won't say which one it is. If you look in the news, you can figure it out for yourself. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a very handicapped person. Now, some of the nonverbals actually have a locked-in syndrome. And in the autistic brain, we profile Carly Fleischman and Tito Makapetehe, who type independently. And they've got a good brain locked inside, but they are going to have to live in supported living.
Right, they don't speak.
They don't speak, and they would never be able to live by themselves. And then you've got people where they've got very severe, barely can dress themselves. You see, and it's all called autism. You know, as we learn more about the brain, we're going to, like, bust it up into its component pieces.
There were a group of researchers, a group of researchers in Montreal whose work was most interesting because they were taking assumptions about something that might have been termed a disability, a liability, and saying, well, let's flip this around. This person can do...
That's
right. Well, you can think in visual patterns. So that's not a disability. That's an asset.
Well, there's a point where mild autism, mild ADHD, mild, tiny little bit of depression, there tends to be more creativity with the depression. The mild versions of these traits can give abilities. And then you get down in the very severe. Then it's obviously a handicap. There's no black and white dividing line between geeks and nerds and half of Silicon Valley and mild autism.
Do you go speak in Silicon Valley?
I mean, well, you know, I have. In fact, I'm going to be going over to Microsoft this afternoon. But they, you know, of course, a lot of those people want to avoid the labels because they want their kid to succeed in Silicon Valley. And I'm seeing too many kids on the milder ends of these spectrums. They're getting way too many drugs. And I've written way too many medications given out like candy. I can't be totally against meds because I'm on antidepressants for anxiety, and it was the best thing I ever did. I know an awful lot of mathematical thinkers and visual thinkers with a little tiny dab of Prozac in the morning. Got to be a tiny dab.
Oops, that's a phone. Got to turn that phone up. Well, gives me a chance to say that Temple Grandin's our guest, and she's got a new book called The Autistic Brain, but doesn't necessarily mean she remembers to turn off her phone.
I had it turned off and in my briefcase. I thought I had it in my briefcase.
One other interesting thing is the idea of self-reporting. So we have this new scientific ability to see, you know, these high-def intersections of fibers in our brain. But then there's people who can tell you, like, it hurts me to go into a room where everybody's talking because it physically is painful in my ears, or some of those self-reporting.
We need to be paying attention to these self-reports. And to study sensory problems, we can't study them based on whether they're autistic or not. We have to study what sensory problems the person has. Because I had a dyslexic student that was definitely not autistic, and she had a horrible problem with fluorescent lights. So some individuals cannot stand fluorescent lights. They see them flicker. And we need to take people that can't stand fluorescent lights. They see the print jiggle on the page. They hate escalators, and they hate driving at night. And we need to put them in a scanner against people that don't have these symptoms.
So what
you've got to study this based on the specific sensory problem.
So essentially, what you do is you need to have the self-reported symptoms and the sort of the scientific actual neuroscience, the work. And
we need to be figuring out how to treat these problems because these sensory issues are vary from a nuisance to making it impossible to tolerate normal environments.
So you sort of, you had this mother who was, you know, going to put you on a path with you, help you get to that path. But by and large, you travel around the world talking about this. Are there enough
lay people like moms or medical health professionals who agree with you and are starting to combine.
I think it's difficult I have been talking about the sensory issues for years and years and years and years. And if you go look through the scientific literature, you'll have 100 papers on face recognition stuff, you know, and they ought to be using that scan diagnostically. It's been around for 15 mm-hmm. years on run-of-the-mill equipment. And there's one paper on sensory. But you see, you can't be studying this based on an autism diagnosis. It's got to be based on the diagnosis for the specific sensory problem, because not everybody has this visual problem. I don't have it. And then there's other kids where certain sounds hurt their ears. There's others that can't tolerate a certain smell.
Now, is that specific to kids who are diagnosed with autism?
No.
All of us have some sort of...
The sensory problems, you can... Sometimes it's called sensory processing disorder. You know, and you see, they're trying to, like, you know, cut the stuff up into, like, different behavioral profiles.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, then I think eventually it's going to get to be the fight between the psychologists and the neurologists. But eventually we need to be figuring out, what do we do specifically to treat the problem with fluorescent lights? And let me tell you a couple of things that do work. One is the Erlen colored lenses, where you try on different pale colored glasses, like light purple, light blue, light pink. You try printing your homework or you're reading on different pastel papers. A lot of people like the older type Kindle because it's less contrast. Mm. You experiment with different backgrounds on the computers and make sure you only use the new screens, phones, tablets, and laptops. Avoid those old, awful screens because they flicker.
It just leaves me, like, listening to you talk about all this and reading the book, you talked about this heterogeneity within the diagnosis of the autism spectrum, is that every single person has to be treated as that single person, that when you go to the doctor or the neurologist or the psychologist, they can't really be looking at the DSM-5
or whatever. Well, the only thing
that,
on a verbal, and I'm going to talk about the fully verbal individuals, thing that kind of goes universally across, are the social deficits. Some social circuits aren't hooked up, and you've got to just teach these kids in the old-fashioned way, the way it was taught in the 50s. This is how you shake hands. You use this much pressure, okay. This much shake. You look them in the eye. You just have to coach them like they're in a play.
You're teaching in a college when you're not off doing this kind of work, this traveling around the country and writing your books work. Do you get a lot of autistic college students who want to take your class because they feel like you're going to understand where they're at?
Well, you're saying there's a lot of kids that are now coming in on the spectrum where before they were just geeky and nerdy before. And, one of the biggest problems I'm seeing is kids getting through college successfully, but then they don't get employment. I'm also seeing some very bad problems with addiction to video games. And some people say, well, you're just no fuddy-duddy. Well, if they were going out and getting jobs in the gaming industry, I'd be all for it, but that's not what's happening. And any benefits you can get from playing video games, it's 30 minutes to an hour a day gives those benefits, not all day. and they're not able to keep jobs. And I think part of the problem is they haven't learned the discipline of work. And by the time I got out of college, I had a little freelance sign business, and I painted signs for the Arizona State Fair stupid carnival.
You're all over the place.
I'll also tell you that on learning how to speak, first time I gave a talk, I panicked and walked out.
And here you are, sitting in the studio. And tonight, Temple Grandin is going to be speaking at Town Hall Seattle. The event is sold out, but Town Hall says they're going to provide maybe some standing room only tickets at 6:30 when the doors open. There's also going to be an overflow room, so you won't be able to see her, but you'll be able to hear her. Temple Grandin's new book is called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. Thank you so much for coming in today.
It's great to be here, and if you're one of those standees, you can still get a book.
You can still get a book. This is Weekday.
The sound of the day.
body itself.
There's a couple of things going on in there. Our listener, Karen, recorded the sound for us. It's male baboons in the Zulu Nyala Reserve in South Africa, and you hear the reserve workers in there with the baboons. What interesting sounds are you listening to wherever you are in the world? Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. Email your sound file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. Coming up in the next hour on Weekday, we're going to hear some more with from Dr. Jim DeMaine about medical interventions and the end of life. And we're also going to talk to archaeologist William Saturno about the ancient Maya. That's coming up. So we hope you stay with us on Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Skanska, committed to construction and development services with innovation and sustainability in mind, providing opportunities for local companies.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.